the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Grail Marcus is my guest this week. The historian of popular music, politics, and the confluence of the two, Grail Marcus has written about Bob Dylan, Elvis Presley, and so many other things. His latest book is The Doors, A Lifetime of Listening to Five Mean Years. Grail Marcus, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's great to be with you.
You know, in the first edition of the Rolling Stone Illustrated History of Rock and Roll, which you made several excellent contributions, your colleague, the late Lester Bangs, said that Jim Morrison, essentially he said that Jim Morrison was a sad, sloppy, drunken clown. And he also said that the significance of the Doors couldn't be ignored. The Stones were dirty, but the Doors were dread. Does dread make the music more important?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a real theme running all through my book, running all through their music. And, you know, as you're quoting Lester, I'm hardly the first person to say so, but it was a theme that I just felt was not only present throughout their music, but really had great depth, something they continued to explore and test, so that it becomes something that carries you through from the very beginning. There's a sense that the world is not the way we want it to be. It's never going to be. There are traps around every corner. We have no idea what they are, or if we're going to be able to get out of them. And there was that kind of realism that in the late 60s, when they first emerged in 67 and for the next few years, not many people were finding a voice for or even believing in.
Oh, do you think they believed in it, or that was their pose and part they were playing as actors in a musical play?
Well, I suppose there's some of that, but I think that, you know, that's their sensibility. That was their purchase on the world. You know, when you're writing songs, when you're painting a painting, when you're making a film, writing a poem, you have to ultimately come face to face with your own point of view if you've got one. And they did. And I think this was it.
As you talk about a lifetime of listening to these 5 years of music, you know, the music has kind of gone through, even though the music is exactly what it always was, but it's kind of gone through changes, I guess critical changes in those intervening years. At some points, you know, the music seemed terrible.
Well, not for me. Uh-huh. The music that always seemed to me embarrassing and flailing around, people having lost their sense of what they were doing and why they were doing it, which happens with their third and fourth albums, with Waiting for the Sun and The Soft Parade, and really carries through into Morrison Hotel and L.A. Woman, although there's marvelous and dynamic, galvanic things on those last two albums.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't bear that music then. I can't really listen to it now. But Light My Fire, over all these years, has never lost its joy, its unpredictability. The way you're so caught up in the music, you forget what's coming next, even though you've heard the song hundreds and hundreds of times, and so much else. And while there's plenty in the end that can seem overblown, that can seem like some film student's misbegotten fantasy, there are parts of it that are still absolutely chilling and thrilling too. So, you know, it depends on who you're talking to. For some people, the Doors never really mattered, never made sense until the end appeared in Francis Coppola's Apocalypse Now, which is something I don't even write about because the song had its life, had taken on its full shape for me in terms of what I had to say about it long before that.
That really did kind of rescue it from obscurity to a certain extent. The way it's used, especially, you know, not only the soundtrack of the movie, but the album, soundtrack album that came out. I mean, they kind of wove it through the whole album. People were listening to it again there for a while.
Sure. And I think, I don't know if it rescued it from obscurity, but it gave it a kind of imprimatur of legitimacy that maybe it had lost by then.
Yeah, again, I think Lester Bangs says something about it not holding up. This when did that book come out? In 75 or 76, saying it sounded bad, you know, when he listened to it then. And that's kind of what I mean about the kind of inconsistency, historical inconsistency of the Doors, whether they matter or not. I remember Rolling Stone running an article about him in the 90s, I think it was, about Jim Morrison, and they had, he's hot, he's sexy, he's dead. You remember that?
Sure.
There was kind of a revival of interest, and it kind of comes and goes. So every once in a while, they put out a new box set or something.
Oh, it seems like every 6 months. It was the Jerry Hopkins, Danny Sugarman biography, No One Here Gets Out Alive, right, biography of Jim Morrison, that was a huge bestseller that did a lot to bring younger people to that music by creating a really kind of nonsensical myth around him, and even suggesting maybe he's still alive, maybe he faked his own death, and maybe he's out there somewhere watching us all laughing. And
he and Elvis.
He and Elvis together in their little Navajo sweat lodge or something. But you know, it all comes down to the music. The reason the music is still on the radio, the reason it still sounds good, is because of what's in the music. Ultimately, a story that's being told, a craze, hype, something coming in or going out of fashion is only going to sustain something on the radio for a very short period of time. The reason you can turn on your radio today and go from station to station and hear Roadhouse Blues, L.A. Woman, Break On Through to the Other Side, Strange Days, all sorts of songs, not just one or two, mm-hmm. is because when they appear on the radio, people call the radio up and say, I want to hear more of that. That's how radio stations work.
Yeah.
Because not just because there's a demand of older people who want to relive their youth, but because younger people, people of all different ages, are hearing this stuff, whether for the 100th time or the first time, and saying, that sounds good to me. That is talking to me. I want to hear more of that.
Well, Grail Marcus, although you've written lots of stuff, and you've written about all kinds of music and politics, by far you've written the most about music from that era, including an entire book about Like a Rolling Stone, right? Do you think there's, I don't know, is there, what about the 60s makes that happen? Is that period of time romanticized or overemphasized, or is it really this incredible period that's greater than any other?
Well, it's certainly not greater than any other. I mean, one of the longest pieces in the book, longest chapters, is just about that question. It's called The Doors in the So-Called 60s, and it's really an argument against the making the 60s into an idea, into a concept, into a legend, into a myth, as opposed to it being a time in which people lived, people suffered, people were afraid, people experienced great joy, were almost constantly living in a state of surprise, felt threatened, and saw things happen of such horror, things that they never imagined could happen, that then became part of their everyday lives and never left them. The assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, so many more people. And it was an enormously confusing and exciting time. And it was an exhausting time, and it did an enormous amount of damage to all sorts of people. It buried a lot of people. And maybe the Doors are part of that, maybe they weren't. But there's no question that it was a time when all sorts of people keyed in to the sense of desperation that really drove those years. And out of that sense of desperation, people had to say, well, you know, what do I have to say about this? What can I do about this? How can I translate this? And so much of that happened in music. And so that music is charged with a greater sense of necessity and a greater sense of high stakes.
The Manson family, you talk about that in your book, as though somehow the Doors' music prophesized the Manson family?
Well, they certainly didn't. Their music certainly didn't prophesize it in any direct way, and I certainly doubt if anyone in the Doors, as they sat down to work out their music, to write a song, to arrange it, were thinking, you know, there's probably this group of really murderous hippies out there somewhere, and, you know, we're going to wake up one day and find out that people were slaughtered in their own homes. I that's not what I meant. What I meant was that this sense of dread that we were talking about before, the sense that things were out of joint, that things were not going to work out the way we expected, that all sorts of things could happen that we could never anticipate. I think that's there in their music, both as mood, as sensibility, and even subject matter. In their first two albums, particularly on their first album from 1967. And so when the Manson family burst into the news, when their crimes made headlines, and then it was discovered, you know, what was behind them, I think people who had listened to the Doors, everyone was shocked. But there's a way in which you said, yeah, I've been there before. I've heard that before. There's a way in which you were shocked but not surprised. Those kind of events had already been countenanced, if not contemplated, in the Doors' music.
Take the highway to the end of the night.
Talk about San Francisco music versus L.A. music and the Doors. What do you think the music in San Francisco was any less important or lasting because it was less dreadful?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was a huge fan of the San Francisco bands, and my wife and I would go over to the Avalon Ballroom or the Fillmore really every weekend to see everybody, the Doors most of all, but everybody. And I loved that music, and it was wonderful stuff. And yet, you know, thinking back over the years, what has lasted for other people and for me, what still has a voice in it, what seems able to stand up to the times and stand up to our times now, and what doesn't. That music was for the most part soft and shallow. You know, there are exceptions. There's this song, there's that song. But when I came down to it, the one song that I could imagine taking out the Doors in a battle of the bands was, an obscure performance by the Great Society of their song Someone to Love,
mm-hmm.
Which is just so harsh and so scary, and so, oh my God, you know, get me out of here before she comes after me. Grace Slick is the avenging angel. There wasn't very much, and it was fascinating to me. Listen, I'm from San Francisco. I was born mm-hmm. here. My parents were born in the Bay Area. I was raised to sneer at Los Angeles, to think, you know, it was the worst place in the world. And so, you know, for me to say no, what was interesting was happening in Los Angeles, and what was shallow and fey was happening in San Francisco. And, you know, I have to give up something to say that.
Why is that Great Society version better than the Jefferson Airplane version?
The Jefferson Airplane version is terrific. I mean, it's a song Grace Slick wrote. She sings both versions. The Jefferson Airplane version is shaped. I mean, it's done in a recording studio. The Great Society's version that I'm talking about was a live recording.
Mm-hmm.
The Jefferson Airplane version is shaped. It is shapely. It is art, and it's finished. And you can stand apart from it and admire it. Whereas the Great Society version is an event. It's happening. When it's over, it isn't something you say, oh, well, that was very nice. The event is still going on, as any event that one takes part in continues after it's, you know, formally over. It stays with you, and you're still caught up in it, and you don't know how it comes out. And you don't know how you got there. I mean, it's music that leaves you feeling stranded and alarmed and helpless. And that's a sensation that can be really irresistible.
Harkening back to that illustrated history of rock and roll that I mentioned earlier, one of my favorite things that you've ever written was your piece about the Beatles in there.
Oh, thank you.
And it was brilliant. And the Beatles, I think the reason the Beatles are still so revered is that they're great. And that is, their catalog is so strong that the worst song on any Beatles album is somebody's favorite Beatles song. When you think about that, and then you think about the Doors in terms of the body of work, well, I don't even know if you want to compare them, but what are your thoughts about that?
I don't think they can be compared. You know, Jim Morrison was a person in real trouble, and being pulled in many directions, being pulled apart by what was happening with his band, with the kind of worship and hatred that he attracted whenever he opened his mouth or walked onto a stage. There was a way in which Jim Morrison was so overweening that people desperately wanted to see him fall. He invited that, and as much as maybe other people wanted to see him fly and believed he could in a kind of artistic sense. Beatles were craftspeople. The Beatles were conscious, serious, working artists, trying both to conquer the world and push their music into places that had never been before. And this was a conscious project. And I don't see how you could compare them. Obviously, they were infinitely more productive. And they were being pushed in a different way. The Doors came out of an art tradition. The Beatles did, too. They came out of art school tradition, as opposed to, you know, somewhat more refined, rarefied UCLA film school. But the Doors always had a sense of themselves as artists, as people making art. That was something the Beatles had to learn. And when they realized that was what was happening, they went after it with all they had. They're very different stories. Maybe if I was in a different frame of mind, I could compare them. But now it seems impossible.
We're talking with Grail Marcus, and his latest book is The Doors, A Lifetime of Listening to Five Mean Years. How do you decide where you're going to go with your writing? I mean, you've written about dead Elvis, you've written about the basement tapes. What's on your mind? What are you going to do?
You mean right now?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure. You know, when I was doing interviews for this book when it was first published, this disc jockey said to me after we got through talking, he said, "Well, what's your next project?" And I said, "Oh, I don't have one. I just finished this." And he said, "Well, why don't you do a book about Brian Ferry?" I'd written a book about listening to Van Morrison and a book about listening to The Doors, and I've always loved Brian Ferry of Roxy Music. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it had never occurred to me to take him on in this way. I couldn't get the idea out of my mind. I have no idea if there's enough there to work with, enough there for me to work with. If I only have one really interesting sentence to write about him or not. But that suggestion really got to me, and so I'm still fantasizing about that.
How do you do it physically? Do you immerse yourself in the music? Do you record your ideas on a tape, or do you just sit down at the typewriter and start typing?
Well, you know, when I'm writing something, yeah, I sit at the computer and just write, and ideas come that way. But also, when you're immersed in a project, everything relates to it. Everything seems to connect, and in any given moment, something will spark an idea. It might be a billboard, it might be a news report, might be a song by somebody else that you've never thought of in terms of what you're writing about that you hear on the radio. And I'll scribble something down. And, you know, while I was writing the Doors book, I was taking a walk in the morning, and suddenly a whole chapter about a song I'd never considered writing about popped into my head, just complete, written. And I rushed home and wrote it down. I was planning to write a chapter about a different song that day, so I wrote about the song I hadn't planned to write about in the morning and the one I had planned to write about in the afternoon. Things like that just happen.
Do you then go back and do a lot of editing, or is your first draft the one you go with?
Pretty much the first draft. I mean, I go back over everything and, you know, I hope make it better. But I don't rewrite much.
Well, I guess because you were in the Bay Area, is that how you started to work with Rolling Stone? I can remember your reviews of albums turning up in some of the earliest issues of Rolling Stone.
Well, I started writing for them in, I guess, the spring of 68, and the magazine started in the fall of 67. Jan Wenner and I had known each other when we were freshmen at Cal in 63. So, and I'd lost touch with him, but I'd followed his career. He wrote for the Daily Cal. He wrote for the Sunday Ramparts, a weekly newspaper. He was their rock critic. And when Rolling Stone started, you know, it was so clear this was his sensibility, and I was reading him there. And so I started sending stuff in, and lo and behold, there it was in the next issue. I thought, this is really easy. So I kept doing it.
Do you still listen to new music? Do you listen to Katy Perry or Nicki Minaj or whatever?
Well, I love Nicki Minaj. Katy Perry doesn't do anything for me. But, you know, the book kind of turns on an axis of driving across the Bay Bridge once or twice a week for a couple of years. And in 2009, 2010, 2011, and hearing Lady Gaga's Bad Romance and Train's Hey Soul Sister just over and over and over. I love both of those songs. And hearing in between them, as I would just jump from one station to the other as soon as a song I liked was over, hearing the Doors constantly threaded between, you know, the music that was being made and utterly dominating the radio right now. So, yeah, you bet.
What if, you know, what if in 1966 the Doors were being played against a backdrop of music from 40 years before that? You know, the Doors and then Gene Austin, and it really wouldn't have worked. It's interesting how music, not just the Doors, but music in general, has not gone through the kind of revolution that happened in the 1960s.
Well, I mean, you really got me going when you said Gene Austin, because Gene Austin had this lovely, warm, full voice that Jim Morrison also had.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would sound real good together. You put Gene Austin's Lonesome Road and the Doors' End of the Night together, I think they'd fit very well. But what you're saying is true. Rock and roll, starting in the early mid-50s, made a breach. It said, you know, line's been drawn, and everything is starting up again as if nothing ever happened before. Any musicologist can show you that isn't true, but that's how the music was experienced. That's how it felt. History began with Elvis Presley and moved on, and there hasn't been an epistemological break since then. You have a kind of parallel history going on with hip-hop, which is part of that stream and not part of it. But there's a continuum of associations, a sense of living in an ongoing historical period that began with rock and roll and is still continuing. So it makes sense. It makes sense in the broadest way to be listening to the Doors next to Lady Gaga, for Lady Gaga right now to be listening to the Doors. For the guys in the Doors who are still around to be listening to Lady Gaga, the language is the same.
The book is called The Doors, A Lifetime of Listening to Five Mean Ears, and the author is Grail Marcus. There's much more to talk about, but our time is up. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. Really enjoyed it.
Well, it was a delight. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and find us on Facebook. I want to thank Grail Marcus. His latest book, The Doors, A Lifetime of Listening to Five Mean Ears. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thank you, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.